First matter up today, docket number 81513, Mack v. Williams. Counselor, are we ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, come on up. Did you want to reserve any time?
Yes, 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
This is Travis Varick on behalf of the petitioner. Travis, and along with Ben Fields on behalf of Amici. One of the joys at my station in life is having younger, smarter attorneys do the grunt work. And in this case, that would have been Mr. Lawrence, but he had his fourth skin graft surgery yesterday following a horrific motorcycle accident. So we're stuck with me.
Happy to have you here.
I assume that the reason oral argument was ordered is because the court has questions that have to be answered, and I want to focus on that. But before we go there, if I may. 1983 is a patch where the country was rolling along after the Civil War, and then we got a flat tire because the states were not enforcing the civil rights of their own citizens. So Congress stepped in, passed 1983. It's not perfect legislation. They could not have anticipated the mountains of case law that have come out of that federal regulation, ever. So they put a patch on it, and years later, Bivens is applied as a patch upon the patch, right? And the state wants to say, if it don't have a patch, it ain't a tire. Okay? So here we are with a question that hasn't come before this court before directly, but here we are. Does Ms. Mack have a right of action? And our position is a right without a remedy is no right at all. So now we swerve right into the main argument, I think, of the state is that there's alternative remedies available to Ms. Mack. So if we're going to turn on points of law, I think that's the question that we have to answer. Are there alternative remedies, but why should we use them? This is a court of common law. Fully vested with the power to declare rights and remedies for its own citizens. 40% of the federal district court docket in Nevada is civil rights claims. I don't think they appreciate that, right? That doesn't make them happy. All these years, the state of Nevada has been dumping its civil rights claims on the front step of the federal court because the state has not expressed any interest in guaranteeing the rights of its own citizens for violations by its own actors. I see. So, if I may, I swerve back to 1983. Again, it was a patch job, could have been better. Two things were missing from 1983. One was any person or entity that violates somebody's rights can be subject to damages. If they'd only put entity in there, we wouldn't have all this Monell stuff, right? And if they'd only put in state or federal law, we wouldn't be here on the same terms. Bivens wouldn't have been necessary. But again, here we are with patch upon patch upon patch, and the state wants to say you don't have a right unless it has a patch. If there's no questions for me, I yield to Mr. Fields.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, Benjamin Field for Amici, Stephen Lara, and the Institute for Justice. I'm joined by my Nevada co-counsel, John Fortin, at counsel's table. The parties and Amici agree that the Nevada Constitution enshrines judicially enforceable rights. Appellant and Amici are asking only that the court take a modest step to fill a remedial gap. The court should exercise its inherent powers to recognize that when the government violates those constitutional rights, one of the remedies available is money damages. Nevada statutes support that conclusion. As this court said last year in Echeverria versus State, NRS Chapter 41 reflects a public policy that the state should generally take responsibility when it commits wrongs. Common law tradition also supports making a damages remedy available. One of common law's core tenets, going back to Marbury versus Madison, Blackstone, and beyond, is that when there is a right, there is a remedy. And in many cases, money damages, or at least nominal damages, will be the only meaningful remedy for plaintiffs. That's why state courts across the country, from California to New York and beyond, recognize damages as a remedy for constitutional violations. This court should join them and hold that damages are available as a remedy for violations of Article 1, Sections 8 and 18, and that there are no special immunities that apply. So taking a step back, all the parties, including the Attorney General, agree that constitutional rights are enforceable and that states can, and that this court can provide at least prospective relief. So as we show at pages 6 and 7 of our brief, there's a long tradition going back to the 19th century of this court providing such relief. And as this court said in Alper versus Clark County, constitutional prohibitions on the state are self-enforcing and give rise to a cause of action regardless of whether the legislature has provided any statutory procedure. The reporter for that is 93 Nevada 569. So we agree that prospective remedies are available for constitutional violations. The Attorney General, the appellant, and the amici also agree that damages are available as a remedy if the violation happens to overlap with a private tort. So all we're asking for is for the court to fill a small gap and exercise its inherent powers to recognize that damages are generally available as a remedy in appropriate cases for a constitutional violation.
Counsel, can you address NRS 41.031 and to what extent that plays into the analysis about whether there is a right of action here?
Absolutely.
And its subsequent sections, I guess, in that part of the chapter.
Yes, Your Honor. So we think that NRS 41.031 and that entire chapter, in line with what this court said in Echeverria, invites liability onto the state. And it recognizes that any claim that could be brought at law, at common law, or by statute can be brought and that the state will bear responsibility for it and will indemnify officers and provide a defense, eliminating any need for something like qualified immunity, which at the federal level is justified only because the individual officer would be liable. So I think that NRS Chapter 41 is an invitation from the legislature to this court to apply common law rulemaking and exercise its inherent powers to remedy wrongs. Just as this court can provide a remedy if an officer commits a trespass, this court should provide a remedy when an officer violates other constitutional provisions that might not overlap with a private tort. And as I've said, courts across the country have recognized that that is an appropriate remedy to provide. So for just a couple examples, California, most fulsomely in a case called Katzberg versus Regents of the University of California, which is reported at 58 Pacific 3rd 339, went through and explained why there should be a Bivens-type remedy in California, because the California Constitution, like this state's Constitution, is the foundational document of government. And if there isn't a remedy to be provided, then the rights guaranteed in those provisions are meaningless. New York has done so in an even broader way and said much more clearly that every constitutional provision is enforceable. That was in a case called Brown versus State, which was reported at 674 Northeast 2nd, 1129. And most recently, the Zullo case that's discussed at length in the appellant's reply brief out of Vermont goes through and says, in Vermont, we're going to do the same thing, looking at all of these states that have followed that tradition for decades. And so all we're asking is this court take the same step and give the same importance to the Nevada Constitution to recognize remedies for violations. Your Honor?
Sorry. I noticed that in one of the subsequent sections in Chapter 41, which is 41.0334, one of the exceptions to immunity is that, you know, you can't bring an action for injuries in a public building if you're engaged in a criminal act. And then there's subsection 2 that says that subsection 1, which reinstates immunity, doesn't apply if the injuries resulted from the deprivation of any rights, privileges, or immunities secured by the United States Constitution or the Constitution of the State of Nevada. Could you, I guess, comment on you know, whether that's some recognition that there are claims available for a constitutional violation?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think that's a very strong indication that the legislature did anticipate that such claims would be available. So as even the Attorney General acknowledges, those claims are obviously available if there's an overlap with a private tort. And so the only question for this court on these certified questions is whether it's more generally available. And the Attorney General places a lot of emphasis on saying the legislature should have to create these remedies. But you know, I think as Justice Kagan's question gets to, this is something that the legislature has anticipated. NRS 41 is all about inviting liability onto the states. As this court said in Echeverria last year, other states, you know, set the opposite presumption that immunity will apply unless there's an express exception. Nevada's the opposite. The legislature has said, we want to right wrongs. And so they've invited this court to exercise its inherent power to remedy those wrongs. And often damages will be the only...
Counsel, don't you think under Article 4, Section 22, the legislature has the sole authority to carve out causes of action?
So, Your Honor, I don't think that that's accurate, and I don't think even the Attorney General is making that argument. So the case I just gave you, the Alper case, recognizes that constitutional rights are inherently self-executing. And I don't think that there's any reason to draw a distinction between injunctive or prospective remedies and retrospective remedies. So, for instance, the injunction statute that the Attorney General cites doesn't have any cause of action creating language. It simply codifies the general equitable standards for granting injunctive relief. The cause of action arises from this court's inherent equitable power. All we're saying is that the court should do the same to exercise a right to recognize a retrospective remedy. This court, exercising its common law power, has created remedies for things like trespass, conversion, all of the common law torts that everybody agrees can be brought against the state. All we're saying is that the court should exercise the same inherent power to recognize deprivations of fundamental constitutional rights. And often, as I was about to say, they'll be the only meaningful remedy. As Justice Harlan's concurrence in Bivens said, for many plaintiffs, it will be damages or nothing. The state shouldn't be able to get away with a constitutional violation just because it's able to accomplish it in a discrete episode and then leave the plaintiff on his own. So in Mr. Lara's case, one of the amici, you know, he had his life savings seized on the side of a highway in a single encounter. He didn't have the ability to bring a declaratory judgment action or an injunction action on the side of a highway. His most meaningful remedy is a retrospective one. And in order for him to have his Nevada constitutional rights recognized, he needs that kind of remedy. And that's why in the court in Bivens and Supreme Courts across the country and the states have recognized that remedies are available. Even the Restatement Second of Torts recognizes that they can be appropriate, they can be available in appropriate cases. A third reason I think this court should recognize that remedy is that often the private torts that we've been discussing won't be a sufficient alternative. So private tort law is built to provide remedies for injuries that private persons commit against another. There often isn't going to be an analog for constitutional violations. So for instance, this state's protection for free speech, you know, simply isn't going to have many private analogs because individual people don't have the same obligations as the government to respect those rights. And the same applies to the due process claims here. There isn't a Matthews test for balancing due process violations between individuals. It only applies to the government. And so the court shouldn't have to go through hoops to try to fit private torts into the government context. It should just directly go to say that if the government commits a violation, we're not going to limit ourselves only to prospective remedies. Retrospective remedies will also be available.
What do you make of the Nevada Constitution's express reference to just compensation in the eminent domain setting and its failure to make comparable references elsewhere?
I wouldn't take anything from that, Your Honor. I don't think a provision has to say that there's a dollar amount involved in order for it to create such a remedy. So first, the Alper case I was citing, I think, says that every provision that places limitations on the government automatically creates a cause of action. That's from this court. And the state Supreme Court's...
Right, but on the prospective versus compensatory remedy issue, you could have a prospective remedy.
Well, Your Honor, none of the provisions, so we all agree that Article 1, Section 8 and 18 are enforceable prospectively, but there's no language in those provisions that says you can have an injunction or you can have declaratory action. It's simply the basic principle inherent to a court of common law like this one, that when there's a violation, you can go into court to have it remedied. And so everybody agrees that prospective remedies are available. I think that the burden is on the government to explain why the most traditional common law remedy of damages is not available. This court has an inherent power to remedy injuries that are done. Everybody agrees that the fundamental rights in the Nevada Constitution should be meaningful. And so the question is just why shouldn't the most traditional remedy be available?
Both with eminent domain, just compensation, and the minimum wage amendment, you have an express provision for damages, money damages. And my question to you is, what should we make of that? How, if you were writing this opinion for your side, would you address those provisions?
So I see that I've moved into the rebuttal time, but I'll try to answer briefly. So I think that Your Honor should look to the Katzberg case out of California and the Brown case out of New York, which address this exact same argument that was raised by the government in those cases. And what the California Supreme Court said is that any constitutional provision that places a limitation on the government, including the Due Process Clause, is self-executing, and even without effectuating legislation, all branches of government are required to comply with its terms. And so it adopted just the logic I was saying and said that money damages can be available in an appropriate case. The New York Court of Appeals, I think, made the same analysis and said, I think quite poignantly, that claimants' rights to recover damages should not be dependent upon the availability of a common law tort. Duties imposed upon government officers by constitutional provisions address something far more serious than private wrongs regulated by common law. So these two courts saw that argument and said, you know, every provision is self-executing, and the default should be that there's a remedy that's meaningful, including retrospective remedies. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the balance.
Thank you.
Good morning, Keel Ireland, on behalf of defendants' respondents. May it please the court. My friends on the other side focus a lot on basically, why do we have to wait for the legislature? Why can't this court just jump in? It's a common law court. And I think there's two answers to that. The first is that, as Justice Herndon pointed out, the Nevada Constitution says specifically for suits against the state, that authority lies with the legislature. It's the legislature that creates causes of action and private rights of action and remedies against the state. The second answer is because this court's case law says that this is a choice for the legislature. Even in the common law realm, in Bodillo, this court said creating new causes of action and creating new remedies for wrongs is a legislative, not a judicial function. And that makes sense when
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
You acknowledge the opportunity to seek prospective relief, injunctive relief, declaratory relief regarding a constitutional violation like the ones alleged here. Why is that authorized but damage remedy is not?
I think that comes from two places, Your Honor. First and most importantly, the legislature has explicitly authorized those actions, especially with declaratory relief and mandamus. They specifically mention constitutionality. And so that shows that the legislature has been very active in the space, and the one choice they have made is not actions damages for constitutional violations generally, although in the inverse condemnation area, they have authorized damages actions. The other place it comes from is there was a common law equitable remedy for constitutional violations. I think the Institute for Justice amicus brief cites a case describing this equitable remedy. So even without a legislative enactment, it's quite possible that there would have been a cause of action for injunctive relief for constitutional violations. But an equitable remedy is not a damages action. It's not a legal remedy. And so that's what distinguishes those kind of cases from what plaintiff is asking for here, which is damages for a constitutional violation that an alleged constitutional violation.
Which statute are you saying specifically authorizes DEC relief as to the constitutional?
I'm sorry, I don't have the statute in front of me, but the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act in the state says that you can challenge the validity of a statute. And I might have misspoken. It might not say under the Constitution, but validity of a statute, I take that to mean under the Constitution. For mandamus, There is a specific statute that says you can challenge prior restraints under the First Amendment and the Nevada analog using a mandamus action.
Because I'm trying to find either in the Constitution or in Nevada statutes some distinction to say you have a remedy for constitutional violations in the form of injunctive relief, but you don't have one in the form of damages. I'm trying to see where that distinction is coming from.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't know if there's going to be any statute that specifically says it. The question is, what has the legislature authorized and what have they not authorized? And they have never authorized a damages action outside of, as far as I'm aware, the inverse condemnation area. Now, a lot of stress has been put on NRS 41031, subsection 1, and I don't think that authorizes damages actions like the one here for two reasons. First, textually, that statute, and I'm going to paraphrase, but it says that the state can be held liable more or less in the manner of private individuals and corporations. And of course, generally, you can't hold a private individual corporation liable for constitutional violations. The Constitution applies to the state. So the legislature would have used different language there if they meant to authorize this kind of damages action. The other reason is because NRS 41031...
Sorry, counsel, in this case, individuals are being sued for constitutional violations and potentially, I guess, depending on what we do, could be liable for constitutional violations, not just the state. Isn't that right?
That's true, but only for the course and scope of their employment, which was for the state. They could not be sued. They could be sued for battery, of course, as individuals, but they could not be sued for a violation of the Fourth Amendment or the Nevada Seizure and Search Clause if they were not acting on behalf of the state. So
if they went a little step farther under this scenario and they actually searched her genitalia for drugs, looking for contraband, the most that they could be sued is just battery, but not for any kind of constitutional violation involved in the strip search? And
Your Honor,
let's just hypothetically say they didn't find drugs as well.
Your Honor, I think there would be two cases that she could bring. She could bring a federal Section 1983 claim, which I think would be identical to the Nevada Constitution claim in this area. And she could also bring a battery claim or perhaps a false imprisonment claim if she wasn't allowed to leave. And that's the traditional way that these kind of constitutional issues have been litigated. They describe this in Bivens that traditionally a plaintiff would bring a common law battery claim. The state defendant would defend it that it was not an unlawful touching because I had a right under state authority to do this. And then to defeat that defense, the plaintiff would say, no, because you violated the Fourth Amendment or the state constitutional claim. And the plaintiff here has not explained why she could not have done that same thing in this case in state court. Instead, she jumped straight towards a constitutional cause of action that has never been recognized by this court.
But Bivens, I mean, the whole point of Bivens was to explain that that wasn't adequate or sufficient to address the constitutional violation appropriately.
I think the reasoning of Bivens why that wasn't adequate for federal officers is because there is a very strange mismatch between holding federal officers liable for state tort claims and where the Constitution would come into that, where federal authority would come into that. We don't have that issue here in Nevada. This would be a state law tort claim analyzed using the state constitution. Of course, all these officers are obligated to follow the state constitution, whether there's liability or not. So I think that kind of federalism concern isn't present here where it was in Bivens.
I want to ask you a question on a different topic before I forget. One of the questions posed to us by the federal court is about what immunities a state actor or defendant can raise as a defense. I understand that on behalf of your clients, the defendants in this case, that qualified immunity was raised. Have any other immunities actually been raised in the case pending in the federal court?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think this is more a general question of if this court is going to import such a huge doctrine of Bivens to give some guidelines to the other courts because they really would have no guidance on how to handle a situation like this because it's never been authorized in the state.
And is it accurate that the only remaining claims on behalf of the plaintiffs in the federal court action that brings us here is just a claim for damages?
Yes. The prospective relief claims have been dismissed. There is a Fourth Amendment claim that will go forward no matter what happens here. So it's not the case that she'll be completely denied a remedy. As I said, she did not bring a state law tort claim. And then there are these two state constitutional claims that could go forward depending on how this court answers the questions.
Thank you.
So to turn back briefly to NRS 41031 subsection 1, that is a way, so first I mentioned that textually it doesn't seem to apply. That's also a waiver of sovereign immunity. It doesn't speak to creating a new private right of action. This case is different than Echevarria, where everyone agreed that there was a private right of action under the FLSA. And the question was, could some kind of immunity be asserted to stop that cause of action? Here, I think we all agree that the legislature has not explicitly created any kind of cause of action like that. And so we don't even get to the step of immunity. And then the final thing I'd say on that point is if you look at subsection 2, it says that the only way that you can bring this kind of claim under subsection 1 is if you name the state as the defendant. And as Justice Kadish pointed out, the state was not named in this case. It was only defendants in the individual capacity. So that could be a way to resolve this case. I think it kind of kicks the can down the road, honestly, because someone will eventually bring that case. But I don't think that NRS section 41031 subsection 1 could impose liability on the state in this specific case.
So let me ask you, as I asked your opposing colleague over here, what do we make of NRS 41.0334, which is admittedly about a different kind of case than we have here, but it seems makes an exception to the waiver of immunity and then has an exception to that exception, so reinstating potential liability for injury resulting from the deprivation of any rights, privileges, or immunities secured by the United States Constitution or the Constitution of the State of Nevada. Does that imply that the legislature assumes there is a claim for relief for a violation of the Nevada Constitution?
I don't think so, Your Honor. How I read that provision is it goes back to what we were talking about with the history of these cases, that there's a tort claim, there's some kind of defense based on the Constitution, and then there's an attempt to defeat that defense. To the extent it could be read differently, then I guess I would say that it shows that the legislature knows how to waive immunity in that specific, very narrow circumstance. And I know there's certainly... I can understand the instinct to, well, the legislature has acted so much in this area, why don't we just fill in that gap? And I think that's exactly what this court said in Echevarria that it can't do, that this is a topic for the legislature, that they are the ones institutionally capable of determining whether there should be a new class of claims, what defenses should go to them, whether there should be some kind of cap on damages. The legislature has aides who have expertise not only in constitutional law but also budgeting. The legislature is able to take money out of different expenditures going forward to make up for the liability that would be put on the state going forward. The legislature is not bound to the record in front of them. They can hear testimony from all sides, not just the parties and the people the parties put in front of them. So this is really the heart of the legislature's institutional specialization. And this is a question that should be left to them. And so far, in the 150 years since Section 1983 has been in force, they've chosen not to authorize this kind of action.
So the only remedy for a violation of the search and seizure prohibition under the Nevada Constitution would be a common law battery claim?
I think that would be one remedy. Of course, Section 1983 would be another remedy.
That's for federal constitutional violations.
Yes, Your Honor, but it will almost
always...
We
have our Nevada Constitution, which to some extent is duplicative, but it doesn't have to be.
That's true, Your Honor. I believe in this instance it is duplicative. The plaintiff has never shown that the Fourth Amendment is different from the seizure and search clause in this instance. But if the concern is developing the seizure and search clause further... To be honest, the number one driver of that...
CERN is a remedy for a violation of a constitutional right.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think I would, not to beat a dead horse, but I would say that that is the legislature's choice to decide that remedy, not the courts. But yes, a battery would be the proper remedy. And again, this constitutional issue would probably come up anyway because the defense would be that this wasn't an unlawful touching because it was authorized by state action. And... That ties into another point, which is, although the Institute for Justice, or my friends on the other side, cherry-pick a couple states that have recognized this kind of remedy, the vast majority of states do not allow these Bivens-types claims. And the number one reason why they don't allow them is because alternative remedies exist, specifically Section 1983 and state law tort actions. And that's the reason why courts as far-flung as Connecticut and Kentucky and Alaska, West Virginia, have all denied this kind of Bivens-type claim. And I don't see any reason why this state has to step out of that line and do something that all those other courts have found is not necessary and actually is contrary to the separation of powers. Our neighbor state, Oregon, specifically held that it cannot create a private right of action for damages for constitutional violations because that's the legislature's job, not the court's. And I would ask this court to agree with the Oregon Supreme Court and the many other states that have declined to recognize this type of action and answer the certified questions no.
I have a question for you on the certified question, and I know there was back and forth between us and the federal district court on what additional light can we shed here on what's pending in front of you. And one of the things that concerns me when you get into these NRAP 5 questions is getting into advisory opinions in areas that may or may not be in play and opining more broadly. What does our analysis add to what is viable in federal court right now? I don't mean to corral you with viable, but I mean theoretically viable. I know you're not conceding liability.
Yes, Your Honor. At least for the Fourth Amendment claim, I don't really see how this would be any different. It would, if anything, it would just lead to a double recovery because the legal issues and the factual issues are exactly the same. For, in all honesty, in the procedural due process claim, it is different because that was dismissed on the grounds of qualified immunity, and this court would have to decide whether the same qualified immunity analysis, which is integral to Bivens, would apply to this Bivens-type claim in state constitutional cases.
But on the Fourth Amendment issue, they're coextensive, right? I mean,
well, the district court held that the state officers were not entitled to qualified immunity.
Okay.
Obviously, it's possible that this court would have some kind of other qualified immunity analysis that could change it. But to the extent it's identical, without conceding away any arguments, it probably would be the same.
So potentially, depending on what we think, if we recognized a claim for relief for violation of state constitutional rights, then we would have to rule on the qualified immunity issue because potentially there would be differences between state and federal law if qualified immunity applies to the federal constitutional claims but not to the state claim. There would be a significant difference.
Yes, Your Honor. It would make state constitutional claims far more attractive to plaintiffs than federal claims because of the qualified immunity issue. And I would just turn back to one thing that my friend on the other side said. I haven't checked the statistic, but it sounds right to me that 40% of the federal docket is civil rights claims. I would imagine that it would become something like that in the Nevada state courts, which might be a good thing, but again, that goes back to if we're having such a huge difference in the case law that's heard by the Nevada courts, it really should be the legislature. That's what this court talked about in Blanton, that when it comes to massive changes in budgeting and resources for the courts, that's really a legislative decision, not a judicial decision. And if there are no further questions, we'd ask that you answer no to the certified questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
So this is going to be like speed dating, okay?
It is. You have
Justice Herndon, to your question, yes, the legislature can, should have years ago, but we, in our age, we know that legislatures aren't reactive. They don't move unless somebody's driving them. Right? So if this court answers the question, yes, now the legislature has something to act on, and if they don't like it, they can go in and then pass a comprehensive civil rights legislation. They're not going to do anything. If we,
you recognize that it seems like maybe it's just recently, but there's a lot of people coming to court saying the legislature won't act, so we want the court to act instead. So on the idea of the legislature, though, let me ask you this. Do you think the legislature has created qualified immunity here?
No, I don't think they've done anything, but here's their chance.
Okay, so hold on. So if we're to adopt your position that the court has the inherent authority to establish these damage-based causes of action, does the court have the inherent authority to establish qualified immunity as well?
Of course. Vermont did it. I don't know that the court needs to go that far because the legislature then can jump in. Did I answer your question?
Sure.
Okay. Justice Pickering, one difference between the state law claims and claims under 1983 is I don't think respondeat superior applies in federal 1983 actions, which means we live with the fiction that the state is not a defendant. That is pure, utter rubbish. The state is indemnifying, defending, they pay the damages, all maintaining this fiction that the state's not, there's no respondeat superiority liability. It might change the tenor of things in federal court when now the state can't get summarily dismissed from a case because there's no respondeat superior. You brought up the just compensation clause of the Constitution and the takings clause. That's an example of the legislature doing, thinking something through and moving forward. They're not going to think through this issue. They're not going to do it. They don't care unless we bring another case like this. They really don't.
Mr. Barrick, while there's a specific authority on eminent domain taking by statute, is there specific authority on inverse condemnation?
I have no idea. But my point is the state...
I appreciate your honesty.
The state conflates statutory interpretation and the rights and remedies and constitutional rights and remedies, and they want to overlay the analysis.
But the Constitution provides for just compensation in the eminent domain arena.
It does.
And it also provides for dollar recoveries in the minimum wage amendment, and it doesn't with respect to anything else that I know of. So what do you make of that?
Well, I actually have the minimum wage case in front of this court right now, if you know, as you recall. Again, that was constitutionally driven. That's politically driven by the hot buttons of the day. Nevada's a land state, okay? And so the citizens are going to push and say, we want protection for land. Nobody gives a patoot about some black woman getting strip searched at the prison. Nobody cares. And those officers were vicious to this woman. And I'm just saying it shouldn't happen.
I'm sorry. Can I ask one factual question?
Yes, of course.
Can we have some more time?
No.
Sorry. Very fact. Just
sorry, bro.
Mr.
There's a
Barrett,
question for you, though.
Factual question. Do you know the nature of the strip search that was conducted?
I do. It was to become totally naked, bend over, grab your cheeks, and spread them both front and back.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Okay, counsel, thank you for the great briefing and the arguments today. Mm-hmm. This matter will stand submitted.